I'd like to call to order the regular meeting of the Investment Oversight and the Audit Oversight Committee. It's now 10:30. Except as provided by law, no action shall be taken on any item not appearing on today's agenda. The Oversight Committee encourages public participation. If you wish to speak on agenda item, please do so during the general public comment period. Public comments may also be submitted electronically by emailing respond@ocgov.com. As a reminder, please be aware that there are microphones throughout the room to record the meeting. Please try to keep side conversations to a minimum. When you are speaking, please turn on the microphone and the red light indicates a live microphone. With that, I wish to ask the clerk to call the roll.
Thank you. Members, please indicate your presence when I call your name. If you are proxy, when I call the name of the member, please announce your name as proxy for the member. Yvonne Roden.
Present.
Tim Johnson.
Present.
Supervisor Doug Chafee. Supervisor Katrina Foley. Michelle Aguirre. Drew Atwater.
Present.
Mark Willey.
Here.
Larry Himmel. Dr. Stephen Bean.
Dean West, proxy for Dr. Bean.
Thank you, and I'll note for the record that we have a quorum. Also, please be sure to speak into the microphone so that the microphone can pick up for the recording, and please mute or set your phones to vibrate for the duration of the meeting. And with that, I'll turn it back over to the chair.
At this time, we will take public comment from members of the public wishing to speak on any agenda item or any other topic under the subject matter jurisdiction of the committees. Are there any members of the public here today who would like to speak? Please raise your hand. Okay, seeing none. Committee members may make announcements, comments, request information, give direction to staff, or suggest future agenda items. Do any of my colleagues on the committee have any comments? Okay, thank you, seeing none. Okay, we will now move on to the agenda items for today. Madam Clerk, would you read the first item?
Yes, item one is to approve the minutes of the August 21st, 2025 regular meeting.
I move that we approve those minutes.
Tim will second that.
I would like to entertain a motion to move agenda item one. Do I have a second? Oh, you did.
Yeah,
okay. You did. So,
okay, so a motion was made by Mark Willey, and it was seconded by Tim Johnson. All in favor, say aye.
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 Aye. Any opposition or abstention? Seeing none, motion carries. Thank you. Next item two.
Item two is to approve the proposed 2026 IOC-AOC meeting schedule calendar.
I would like to entertain a motion to move agenda item two.
Yeah, Tim will make that motion.
I second.
Motion was made by Tim Johnson and seconded by Mark Willey. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Any opposition, abstention? Seeing none, motion carries. Okay, thank you. Next are the Investment Oversight Committee matters, and I'll ask the clerk to read item three.
Item number three is to receive and file the quarterly report on the county treasury and investments for quarter ended September 30th, 2025, and we have Dana Schultz, Assistant Treasurer Tax Collector, to present on this item.
Good morning, committee members. Can everybody hear me?
Yeah.
Do I have a clicker or? Yeah, sorry. All right, for item number three, you guys have in your packet the full investment committee report. This meeting, we additionally included the PowerPoint, the brief summary that we're going to go over as requested at the last meeting. So here's the executive summary. This is as of September 30th, 2025. The fund balance for OCTP was approximately $14.5 billion, with $6.7 billion of that being associated with the county funds and about $7.7 billion with Orange County Department of Education funds. The portfolio remains primarily in U.S. Treasuries and government agencies. There's approximately 93%, with the remaining 7% in the money market mutual funds. The monthly gross yield is 4.09%, with a year-to-date yield of 4.06%. And we are currently forecasting conservatively approximately 3.75% net yield or gross yield at the end of the year. The net asset value remains at 1, with a duration of 0.65, and year-to-date earnings of $152.6 million. Our cash projections show adequate liquidity to meet liabilities for the next 6 months, and there's more details in the full quarterly report. The next slide goes over the investment policy limits and compliance summary. There's no real changes to that. It's just showing the picture of all of the different limitations, rating limitations, everything in one brief slide. So I'm not going to spend too much time on that. I want to make sure we spend more of our time for going over the investment policy. The next slide is the compliance summary. There's no compliance issues currently. On the quarterly compliance, I'm just going to highlight a few of these, not go through everything in detail. The review of the audit priorities we discussed at the last Audit Oversight Committee, Investment Oversight Committee, we had identified the priority was to do the current quarterly compliance audit as the change of investment authority had changed, the investment policy had changed, and we felt it was more fiscally prudent and risk averse to do the current quarter to make sure that we were in compliance with the new investment policy. So that has been completed and I believe is presented for number 4. So we'll go over that in more detail. So that is complete. And then we are working on the other quarterly compliance reviews that we hope to have done by end of this month. The 9/30/2025 and 12/31/2025 are those reports that I mentioned. And then 6/30/2025 is in progress. I don't have an estimated completion yet, but we will get to that as soon as the others are completed. The annual compliance audit for 6/30/2024 is in progress with Brown Armstrong. And then the quarterly schedule of assets, we received the draft for the September 30th report from internal audit on October 29th, and the 12/31/2024 and 3/31/2025 reviews are in progress. The annual schedule of assets engagement letter was signed, and we will go over that more in item number 5. Here we have the summary of investment data and trends. So year over year, we're pretty consistent with our pool balance right now. Quarter over quarter, we have gone down, but that's a lot related to timing of investment revenues, market rate impacts. But like I mentioned, we're pretty on track with how we were last year. The weighted average maturity is lower year over year. As this point in time, we've been holding a higher number in our money market mutual funds. At this point last year, the balance had got lower than we really wanted to. So we made sure we're keeping it up about 7 to 9% usually to ensure we have sufficient liquidity. I'm not going to go over too much in these trends. We've got the Orange County portion of the pool. And if anybody has any questions, please stop me if you have any questions on these. But it has the top 10 participants. You'll also find that in the full quarterly report. And then the schools portion here. Economic summary. So at the issuance of this report, the government shutdown was still in effect. So some data was not available, but yay, yesterday, if everybody was paying attention to the news, government shutdown officially over after 43 days. So we're still waiting to get everything back to the normal, but then hopefully we'll have our data up to date for our next report. Employment gains and unemployment rates were pretty consistent from the prior quarter. Noting California's rate is higher, and we attempted to get the committee's feedback of wanting more Orange County specific data. So we're starting to incorporate in this report more Orange data, and we hope to get more. But on the employment rates,
California's was higher. It was 5.5% compared to 4.3% state or nationwide. But Orange County is more aligned. We're only 4.6%. So we're more on track with the nation and doing better than everybody else in California. CPI is up 3% year over year, but we're still near the 2% Fed target rate. In this data, it does not include any impacts from the tariffs, though. The Treasury yield curve remains inverted for tenors between 1 and 3 months. However, beyond 3 years, 3 years begins to move toward a steepening curve. I will show you a chart later in here that kind of depicts the Treasury yield curve, and then we'll discuss in more detail there. GDP is going strong, 3.8% as an annualized rate, driven by a decrease in imports and increase in consumer spending. We've added a little bit more OC data, so you have the median home price, which has declined 4.7 to approximately 1.4 million, aligning with the state line decline, statewide decline. Mortgage rates are in the low 6% to be expected and hoping to draw in additional buyers. The FOMC at their September 17th meeting did approve a 25 basis points cut, bringing the range from 4.0 to 4.25%. This report was done as of September 30th, so it does not include the decision at the October 28th meeting where they cut an additional 25 basis points. So the current range is now 3.75 to 4%. Mentioned, I'm going to skip through some of these slides. It just has economic data not pertinent to this meeting. If anybody wants to see anything or has questions specifically, let me know. But I am going to start. This is the one I was talking about, the yield curve. So this is a Treasury par yield curve, and it has the rates through here. What I wanted to highlight here is I had the team add this red dashed line that you see in the middle of that graph because I want to depict what actually applies to Orange County. So this Treasury year curve goes out through 30 years. And for those of you that are familiar with our investment policy, we cannot make investments out to 30 years. So you'll notice everything to the left of that line, 5 years and less, is what we actually are authorized to make purchases of. So it kind of puts it into perspective where that yield is that we don't really have. Like if somebody is wondering, how come we're not buying something up there in the high yield in 4.5%, 5%, we're not eligible for that. So I wanted to just highlight that so everybody saw where we're at and where our portfolio is. Let's see. I think that's median. These are all the, so I don't know if anybody has any questions on that summary.
I don't know if this would be the point in where I would ask, but in reviewing the Treasury report of asset, there appear to be a discrepancy on page 6 with the capital projects and the internal service fund. Your pie shows one figure, but the ledger shows another. And maybe some eagle-eyed public person might see that and want to make sure.
Are you referencing this chart? Yvonne?
It was the, as of August 31st, 2025.
Oh, the treasurer's report. We're not discussing that item right now. So
okay,
I
got that as part of the quarterly report. So I prepared for it, thinking it was gonna be in this meeting because it came after our last meeting. So I can show whoever afterwards.
Yeah, I'll look at the report. I don't think it's included. The treasurer's schedule of assets is not issued by the county executive office.
Okay, who would do that? It was a treasury report of assets distribution.
Yeah, so that's good. Okay. I believe I'll touch base with you after. I believe you're okay. Talking about the report issued by the treasurer's office.
Yes.
So we can stop by and check with you.
Okay,
and
on that same report, you have a distribution list on the back with the IOC members. Mm-hmm. Larry's name was omitted.
Okay.
So if you could also take a look at that as well.
Yes, I'll let Treasurer Frieda Rich and her assistant who works on the distribution aware of that.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Yvonne. Yes.
I was curious on the history. Has the county ever looked at, because I know that in California Investment Code, you can invest in securities greater than 5 years, but it just takes an express authorization from the supervisors. Has the county ever looked at that to diversify?
We have not. A lot of, we've tried to match our maturities with our liabilities. And so, you know, investing in those longer term can create risk, especially if you can't liquidate quickly. We don't really have a lot of excess funds to be able to make longer term investments. I know there are some counties that do that. I would think San Bernardino might be one of them, but we haven't really looked at that.
Makes sense.
Yeah.
Because there are longer term programs, things like funding capital or something like that, appreciation fund for different departments or something
right.
like that. It might be valuable. But...
Definitely. Thank you.
Sharon, do you have something?
Oh, I'm sorry, Sharon.
It's all right. Thank you, Chair Roden, for recognizing my request to speak. You mentioned about the treasurer's monthly report, and we will certainly take a look at that to see if there is an error between the chart that we produce on it. So thank you very much. It also provided me a good opportunity to indicate that in Government Code 53646, it does define the county treasurer as the treasurer for county government, and they are the ones to prepare the official reporting on certain informational items outlined in that law. And so I did want to inform the committee, I am continuing to provide that report. There is not any investment data specifically required by law, so I'm performing those duties as outlined in the law for me to provide that report. The law did become optional. It was mandatory after the bankruptcy. It became optional, but the legislature did ask that the reports be continued to be done by those elected officials as if it were still mandatory. So I continue to do that. Those reports are available on the TTC website, and I'm not sure that because the Investment Oversight Committee is not defined like the Treasury Oversight Committee, if we're actually reporting on the distribution list, I was going to let you know it was going to be available on our website for it, but we will check that list. And I'm sorry, Mr. Himmel, if we do have the Investment Oversight Committee and we didn't have you. I also did note that in the distribution list for the report on the agenda, it is important for me to be included because I am a non-voting member of the IOC and a department head, and I did not see my list, my name on there either. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Madam Clerk.
Item 4 is to receive and file the compliance monitoring of investment portfolio for quarter ended March 31st, 2025. And we have Dana Schultz, Assistant Treasurer Tax Collector, to present on this item.
Good morning. This is receive and file of the compliance monitoring investment portfolio for quarter ending March 31st. As I alluded to earlier when discussing the compliance summaries, this was completed with no findings. And I had already discussed the priority of the audits. We had done this one first as the new change in the investment authority and the investment policy. We wanted to make sure that if there was something we weren't doing correctly, we fixed it right away. And luckily, we found out we were doing great. So that's it. If there's any questions on the report.
Any further questions or discussion? Next item.
Hi, I'm sorry. Chair Roden, I did just want to include that the report that was not, the one report that was delayed was the annual compliance report as of 6/30/24 that is required by law under Government Code Section 27134. This was related to the Treasury Oversight Committee, and so I was not, I missed the August meeting, and so it sounds like based on the information it was decided at that meeting, and I'm just letting you know I was not aware of that because it is one of my mandated duties by law to provide that annual compliance, and now it was supposed to be finished by the end of October. It is over 16 months since that period. It's been delayed, but I do want to put it on the record that it is coming. Hopefully now that this other audit is done, we will get it done as quickly as possible with Brown Armstrong.
Thank you. Next agenda, item 5.
Item 5 is to receive and file engagement letter on review of Treasurer's Schedule of Assets as of June 30th, 2025. And we have Dana Schultz, Assistant Treasurer Tax Collector, to present on this item.
Good morning again. So this is for the audit of the treasurer's schedule of assets. The engagement letter was signed by Ide Bailey and by us on 10/28/2025. This year, we anticipate this to be much smoother. This will be our second year doing full accrual basis to be in accordance with GAAP. So we hope to get that done very, very smoothly, but we're starting work on that now if there's any questions on that.
Any further questions or discussion? Yes.
Thank you again, Chair Roden. This duty of preparing reports and having my records available for inspection is outlined specifically in law as an important oversight and supervision role of the Board of Supervisors over elected officials such as myself as the treasurer tax collector. And pursuant to Government Code Section 26920, which is under the auditor controller, the treasurer is required to present quarterly and annually a treasurer's statement of assets for reviews and audits respectively. This engagement letter for these reports is one of my most important duties outlined in law as it requires me to submit the statement of assets and the county treasury for inspection and audit by the auditor controller. Therefore, I had requested to be the speaker on this item, consistent with other items being presented by department heads, and as it is one of my most important duties in state law. And I also wanted to let you know that there have been other engagement letters on the reviews of the schedule of assets we have received since the last meeting that have not been a receive and file, and so I'll work with the CFO to determine if they should also be put on at a later meeting because we in the past had not put on engagement letters. But because I recognize it's important to have transparency, we started last year adding all engagement letters to our website so that anyone could actually see those engagement letters along with the actual audit reports. The other item on this engagement letter is the agenda item identified it as a review, and it actually is the audit as of the 6/30/25. So I would ask the record be corrected when you do the receive and file that it be corrected to it is the not a review of the schedule of the schedule of assets, it's the audit of the schedule of assets for reporting purposes. Thank you for allowing me to speak.
Thank you.
Yes.
And there's a lot of information going on right now, and I know this we're new.
Come on now, thank you. We did have in our PowerPoint presentation and also included in our report, we have that page that has a summary of all of the investment policy and investment oversight committee compliance summary, and all the items I believe that Sherry mentioned were included on there that we did also review as well. So it's not anything new, just so you know that it was included in the report already. Thank you.
Any further discussion or concerns, issues? Madam Clerk, item number 6.
Item 6 is to review Orange County, California investment policy, and we have Dana Schultz, Assistant Treasurer Tax Collector, to present on this item.
The one we've all been waiting for. Okay, so I'm going to just go through and highlight the changes to the investment policy. I'll try and guide you through looking at the redlined document. So starting on page 5, and we won't have it up here unless, nope, okay. So follow along in your packets, the redlined investment policy, page 5, under authorized investments. I'll give everybody a second to get there. So we just revised the language to remove some of the daily operational functions of the investment accounting team. It was, yes.
I'm sorry, where are you referring to when you're seeing the materials that we should... I don't think I have a red line.
It should in the packet. Be. So if you look under the item, it first has the clean version, and then right after it should have the red line version. It was in the packet sent out by the clerk of the board.
I don't have that.
And there's the authorized investment.
It's not. Is it the same?
It's on page 5. Yeah, it's page 5 of that.
Okay. Do you have a red line?
The electronic packet did include the clean copy first, and then behind it, the red line.
I have my red line.
Ah, okay. Let's see what you're saying.
By now. Thank you.
Okay. Now we're good. Okay.
Thank you.
So on the red line, if you look at page 5 of 25, under authorized investments, we removed the language that talked about the daily operational function of the investment accounting and made it more specific or more generic to the county investment manager, as well as add a clarification regarding an annual review as part of due diligence. The next edit on page 8, if you look under section 7 for money market mutual funds, we removed duplicative language as it was already addressed in section 6 of the policy. And then under the same page, number 10, under medium-term notes, we updated the limitation from 2 to 5 years and added clarification that the limit included in the IP on medium-term notes is ours rather than maximum maturity of the instrument. So we define medium-term notes for our policy as 5 years, but in the general world, they can go in excess of 5 years. Page 10, section 11, under investment pools, we cleaned up some of the language to align with the language and comments we had in section 6, just trying to create consistency and clarity throughout the document. And then under section Roman numeral 7, under the investment credit rating restriction, we cleaned up some language for securities, regarding downgrading of securities, intent to reviews. It was kind of written as the intent was look to sell, so we made it more generic to look to hold or sell. On page 12, you'll see the issuer concentration underneath there. There's the table. So we updated, as referenced earlier, the medium-term notes to extend the maximum maturity from 2 to 5 years. Additionally, we updated the commercial paper from 270 days to 397 days. And the reason for that is to align with Senate Bill 595. Basically, what happened is the Securities and Exchange Commission had updated and allowed counties with excess of $100 million in excess funds to be able to be qualified as institutional buyers, which basically meant they could buy additional types of commercial paper without with longer maturities. But as you guys know, we're restricted by Government Code Section 53601 and the 270 limit. So it basically made us not be able to do what the SEC was allowing us to do. So the California Association of Treasurer Tax Collectors worked, brought that up to the state, and included the increase to 397 to allow that to actually occur. Page 13, number 3, under duration.
Dana, can I ask a question before we go a little any further?
Mark.
So can you give me an overall reason we're making these changes? You know, we're this is new for us, right? The investment oversight. And secondarily, when we see changes, what precipitated the need for those changes?
Okay, so some of the changes in the language clarity, we've come through going through the different audits. So when we have something in my investment accounting team, I have Brian, my investment accounting manager here, when we're going through audits and working with auditors and they've got a question on, we had a downgrade in securities and trying to interpret the investment policy to determine, was it a compliance violation? Was it not? So we take those conversations throughout the year. And if we find something that is not very clear, we table it to update in future iterations so that while we're going through this process, it's very black and white in certain aspects.
So do we see having an update like this annually, or is this just very once in a while when something comes up?
I don't anticipate it annually. We'll have to update, obviously, if there's legislative changes like SB 595, which I mentioned. But I think we're getting pretty close, and this is like an additional cleanup item since last iteration was significant.
When's the last time this had been updated?
When the Board of Investment Authority went back to the board.
And what year was that?
2025.
Okay, so This is a cleanup
so
from...
It was a significant rewrite when the investment authority shifted back to the board.
Right, and so this is just cleaning up those, if you will, bylaws, those investment policies from the change. And so, again, we're doing oversight, and so how many people, just so that we don't have to do this again, you looked at it, how many people approximately reviewed this before it came to us so that we get an idea of the kind of review that was done beforehand?
So my investment officers, the ones actually performing the investment, they did it. The investment accounting management staff and his team reviewed. My director of treasury, June Intal, who you guys have seen here, he's not here today, he reviews it. I reviewed it. Lewis McClure from CEO Public Finance, Kim Engelby, the CFO, Michelle Aguirre, the CEO.
Okay.
It's gone through extensive
I'm just trying to get a feel because, you know, we come here once every quarter to kind of get a feel, and we rely on you guys. I mean, we're here and we'll on occasion find something that doesn't make sense and we'll ask the question, but generally we're relying on you to provide a good product. So thank you for the explanation.
And the feedback you guys provide us is very important to us too and can help. Okay, back to page 13, number 3, under duration, it's been typically 1.5. The recommendation is to update that to 3 years. This does not mean that we will put the portfolio out that far, but to your point exactly, we don't want to have to keep changing the policy every time something changes. We feel comfortable with adding the 3-year in the policy, knowing that we'll do it based on what, you know.
And the same time with what you showed us, the further out you go, the better the yield. So it's a, you know, there's a risk versus yield.
Exactly.
That you're kind of balancing as you move forward. And the and while it's not the treasurer looking at that, there are people now looking at that delta as we move forward.
You beat me to my next point, which was going to be with the decline in interest rates. We do want to, if we have the ability, to purchase maturities out farther. Page 17, section 17, under performance standards, we, again, as a removal of duplicative language that was addressed elsewhere within section 1 in the investment policy. And the only thing to add on here that I do see that we inadvertently missed is just in the glossary update, we did not update the commercial paper from the 270 to 397. So if I can just note that for the record, that we'll make that update on the investment policy.
Another question, if we could. So the only change that you have to the issue, the compliance chart there is the commercial paper one, right? And it sounds like with your emphasis on the yield curve and under 5 years is where your investment authority is the commercial paper was identified as maybe an area where you have a little more flexibility, but weren't used, and that was done by the Treasurers Association action to get legislation so you could take advantage of it. But it still seems to be restricted to like 1 year, 397.
For those specific commercial paper, but then we also have medium-term notes that was also updated. So medium-term notes wouldn't necessarily be associated with our securities. That would be more of those type of long-term investments. And that will allow us to go up to 5 years with those.
Okay. The court on the investment pool section 11, where the red line struck out quarterly, are we eliminating something there, or is this? It seems like. Is this a non-required activity or review related to so the county investment manager shall be required to investigate all local government investment pools prior to investing. Well, you're not doing that investment out. Your only investment outside the treasury is the LAIF, right, as it is right now for other pools.
Right.
So you're not really, this is not really an active section, but would be required to look.
Right. Yeah. So the changes were to align some of the information in here, minor cleanup items that I didn't go into were language was specifically vague or didn't provide enough direction. So we're not removing any reviews. We're continuing all of our reviews. But we wanted to make sure that we didn't have conflicting language on the reporting requirements throughout the document. And so that's where we removed that. But we're still continuing all of our regular reviews. And we've actually added language in the other sections earlier to clarify, like, annual reviews.
Okay. Yeah, and that was number 11. But Roman numeral 7 below that, the other changes that you're making. I guess the question I have on that is, the only thing that stood out to me is the buy versus hold, the hold or buy. I guess when something drops below the rating requirement that you have a decision whether or not you're going to hold that to maturity or sell that. And that, is this changing the policy or is this just clarifying
it's a clarification,
what you do
yeah.
in practice?
Yeah, it's a clarification. And this is one of the ones, the example that I had provided where we had an audit where we were actually internal audit. Sherry, our treasurer, Freedom Rich, had actually pointed out where we had a downgrade, a negative watch downgrade that required written approval from the treasurer. So when we were trying to interpret the language to identify what we should or shouldn't have done with the securities and getting the approval, it could have been interpreted multiple ways. So this language was trying to clean that up. And then also, when you look at it, there's other factors than just is it a negative watch. So sometimes the U.S. Treasury or a government agency could be put on negative watch, but they are stable funding. So we didn't want it to look as though it's take a look and see if we should sell it. It's evaluate it so that we look not just on do we want to sell it, but what are the benefits of holding it.
And so if that happens now, let's say, does that go up to the CFO, CEO,
yes.
And then it's just that stays internal, or does it come at some point reported to the oversight committee on a downgraded stock, or it just comes up in the quarterly compliance related to maybe something that is picked up by auditors? What's done physically when that actually happens?
So the internal process, we require written approval. So we will escalate that up through the CFO under the board's authority to get written approval. My team will conduct an analysis and provide explanation as to why we believe it should be either sold or held. And then we document everything. We identify negative watches in our quarterly investment reports. So it is put out there through documentation. I don't know that we specifically like agendize an item to bring it to the investment oversight committee. But if there was something that came, we would bring it up during our updates on the investment reports.
Okay, thank you.
Good.
Are you done?
Yes.
Thank you. I just want to identify for the record, I know this is the first time, or I think this is the first time an IP has been on the IOC agenda. I think when it was approved last year, it had not been. So Government Code Section 53646 defines that for county government in A1, only the county treasurer can submit a statement of investment policy. And it is, as I mentioned earlier, it used to be mandatory for that to happen. Now it is optional. And if the county treasurer does submit a policy, it is required to be reviewed and approved at a public meeting. So I do plan to submit a policy, as I've indicated. It will certainly be out of my control once I submit it. I am letting you know I will be submitting a policy per law, because the investment policy statement that is outlined in state code is the one that I am focused on doing, similar to when it was the Treasury Oversight Committee, that was also identified in state law. And then on this, I also want to note that the county investment manager has been added to the glossary, which is helpful because I was unclear as to what position that actually was. And so I think in the new IPS here, I don't believe it was in last year's. I did just look that it has been added in the glossary, which is great news because I think transparency is always very important. Thank you.
Thank you. Any further questions, discussions? Thank you, Dana. Okay, that concludes the Investment Oversight Committee matters. We'll take a brief pause before going into the Audit Oversight Committee items. Mr. West, you're welcome to stay with us, but your presence is not required.
Thank you, and Dr. Bean would like to let you know his obligation. He'd love to be here, but he couldn't today, but thank you, and I'll be leaving. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Okay, we will reconvene in 5 minutes, and that's going to be at 11:15. Thank you. Okay. Okay, we're back to order and begin the Audit Oversight Committee items. Madam Clerk, would you read item 7?
Item 7 is to approve the minutes of the September 30th, 2025 special meeting of the Audit Oversight Committee.
I move.
I would like to motion was made by Mark Willey, and it was a second by Jesus. Your last name?
Donna Purse.
Okay.
I got it. Thank you.
Can you spell that?
Next item, please.
Actually, ask for the vote.
Oh, yes. All I'm sorry. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Any opposition or abstention? Seeing none, the motion approved.
All right, item 8 is the election of officers for 2026.
Okay, I would like to entertain a motion to nominate as chair, Kim Johnson. Do I have a second?
I second that motion.
Motion was made by Yvonne Rowden and second by Mark Willey. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Any opposition or abstention? Seeing none, motion carried. Do we have a nomination for vice chair?
Yeah, Tim would like to nominate Mr. Mark Willey as the vice chair.
Second. Okay, the motion was made by Tim Johnson and second by Larry Himmel. All in favor, say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Any opposition or abstention? Seeing none, motion carried. Thank you and congratulations, Chair, Vice Chair.
Thank you. Yeah, exactly. Depending on how you look at it.
Okay, next on the agenda, item 9, please.
Item 9 is to receive and file a presentation by Orange County Employees Retirement System regarding current and future funding. And we have Brenda Schott, Assistant CEO of Internal Operations for OSERS, to present on this item.
Good morning. Thank you for having me. Again, I'm Brenda Schott. I'm here on behalf of Mr. Steve Delaney, our CEO. He sends his regards. He loves coming to make this presentation every year, but he's out traveling on a well-deserved vacation, so he sent me in his stead. A little bit for those of you, make sure. There we go. A little bit about OSERS. We just celebrated our 80th anniversary, so it's very exciting that we've had this long tenure of providing benefits to our members. We are one of 20 counties within the state of California who has their own separate pension system. We were formed under the California Government Code on a section that we refer to very fondly as the 1937 Act. And like I said, it regulates the 20 systems who elected to be separate from CalPERS and have their own individual county systems. Who we serve. Obviously, the county is our largest participating employer, but we also are very proud of the other participating employers that participate in our plan. We have the city of San Juan Capistrano, our single city, that chose to join the OSERS plan instead of CalPERS. And then we also have several of the different special districts within the county that participate in the plan. How big are we? We have a total membership of just about 55,000 members. About 33,000 of those members are either actively working with one of our participating employers or they have deferred. So they're no longer working, but they're still in the plan, not yet receiving their benefits. The other 22,000 are actively receiving benefits, either as a retiree or a beneficiary of one of our retirees. You can see over the years, our membership continues to grow. We're averaging somewhere between 2.5 and say 3.5 per year. And that really is a testament of just the maturity of the plan. Employees do their employment for their period of time. They retire. Their employer replaces them with somebody else. So membership continues to grow. In addition to over the years, staffing at the different employers can grow as well. So you might have an expansion of staff in some years, and in others, we do recognize sometimes it maybe stays steady or retracts a little bit, and that's where you see that fluctuation in the growth rates. So our pension promise, when we look at what it is that OSERS is promising and what we are here to administer, we look at every member of OSERS, and we look at the benefit that they are either actively accruing benefits for or are retirees, and we say, what are the total benefits that are promised based on what we know today? And when you take the future, the present value of all those future payments, we are at $33.5 billion worth of pension promise. Of that amount, we look at what's actually been accrued. So there's a lot of assumptions that go into all of these numbers. When you're looking forward to say, what is somebody's benefits going to be, you look at not just what is the formula that's been promised, what is their salary, because the basic calculation of a benefit is based on individual salaries. How long do we think they're going to work? When are they going to retire? And then how long are they going to live? So there's a lot of assumptions that go in this, and we'll talk about those as we go along. But when you look at the actuarial accrued liability of all of those things, this is what people have actually accrued as a benefit. So the first number is what we think we're going to pay out in all future benefits. This is what we know has already accrued as a liability. And so that's the $28.3 billion. And then we have two different numbers for assets, and you might wonder why we do that. One is just a snapshot. When we say the market value, we look at it. We work on a calendar year, so as of December 31st, we look at what is the value of our portfolio, and that's the market value of our assets. But when you're talking about funding for a pension system, we want to create some stability and predictability for our employers when you calculate how much they owe each year in contribution rates. So in order to make sure we smooth that out, we smooth all gains and losses over 5 years in the portfolio. So whether we have a really great year or a not so great year, we don't want the employer to have to guess on what their contribution rates are going to be. So we smooth that out over 5 years. So when you see us talking about our assets on the valuation basis, that's taking into consideration that smoothing. And so with that, we look at our unfunded liability, which is the number a lot of people focus on, right? How much do you not have? And so at this point, at 12/31/24, that's at $4.5 billion. And I'll talk a little bit more in the upcoming slides of how that happens and what it's made up of and what we're doing with it. So our unfunded liability, like I mentioned, is $4.5 billion. You can see on a funded ratio, so that's another focal point that people look at when looking at a pension plan, how well are you funded? And so the goal is 100%, right? We want to have every dollar that we need to pay out for all of the benefits. But do you need them all today? So when you know your child is going to college and they're in fourth grade, do you need to have all of those college payments in the bank today? No. know. You have some time. So it's the same thing with the pension. Our goal is to get to the 100%, but we know we don't need them today. So we really have that long-term outlook. And what people look at as a healthy plan is when you're over 80%. So you hit that target. An actuary might tell you there's no such thing. That's just a made-up target. But it really does show that you're on the right path. 80% is a healthy system. And so as you can see, on both a funded ratio or market value basis and on a valuation basis, we've achieved that. And so we're really happy about that. And you'll see as we talk further about what we're doing and how we've achieved it, we feel very confident that we're going to continue just moving even higher funded in the future. Give you a little bit, lots of numbers on this. We won't go through all of it, but I think the focal point on this slide is to just show that progression. If you look back at 2015, we were just about 70%, 71%, and over the years, we just continue to improve on that funded ratio to where we've hit that over 80% mark. The other factor that you can look at to look at the affordability of a plan is looking at the ratio of all of the salaries, projected salaries of the contributing employers and their employees. What is that compared to your UAAL? So the higher the percentage, the more expensive it is as a ratio of those salaries. And as it gets lower, it just becomes a more affordable plan. So you can see we've made really good progress on that affordability factor as well. I will point out on the bottom of the screen, those are the funded ratio on the market value. And so that kind of highlights, you see how much more it fluctuates and why we do the smoothing of assets, because otherwise it would be too much unpredictable contribution rates for our members over the years. But you see, you can identify when there's been a rough investment year and when there's been a good one, because you see much bigger fluctuations in that funded ratio. And so what causes that movement? How is it that our UAAL, you know, changes each year? So you start at where you ended last year, and we always know we have another year of service, the liability is going to grow. So that's a known increase in your liabilities. But then you also know that we have very dependable employers who are very responsible with their contributions. We know that those contributions are going to come in as well. And then we look at the balance, and there's an interest accrual on the balance of that amount owed. And so that is what we would expect the UAAL to be at the end of the year. It's very a mathematical equation that we can put in there and know what we're going to expect. But like I mentioned, there's a lot of assumptions when you talk about the liabilities. A lot of assumptions have to be made. Are we going to we assume that we're going to earn 7% every year. I think everybody knows that nobody has a crystal ball, and we will probably never achieve exactly 7%. There's always going to be over or under in every year. And so you have that factor that we have to then, it gets applied to the UAAL. When we have a really good year, like we did in 2024, you have a reduction of your UAAL. In this case, it was $135 million. The other thing that we assume is the salaries, how much individuals will make and how much payroll in total is going to be for all of our employers. And then our contributions are a basis of that. So it's a percentage of those salaries that we're anticipating. If salaries are higher than expected, we get more contributions than we expected. So then that would actually reduce your liability. That being said, those higher salaries also result in higher benefits. So you go down a couple of lines and those salary increases get offset by higher liabilities because now we think your benefit's going to be higher. So that impacts that liability as well. And then we have a couple other things that are maybe a little bit unique to us. We have several of our member participating agencies who are able to make additional contributions into the plan more than what we would call our required contributions. So in general, that reduces their liability, but the total liability of the whole plan as well. And then I mentioned all of the other assumptions that go in. So when we look at the reality of how old people were when they retired, what was the mortality rates, things like that create either gains or losses each year. Each of it, when we talk about this is our total amount of the liability, which it gets us back down to that 4.5, just rounded up to $4.6 billion. But how do all of those gains and losses get paid off, right? And so we looked, one of the things that the OSERS board did back in 2012, 2013, is they took a very important change to how the system is funded. And they took all of our liabilities and they put them into a single layer. And then they approved a 20-year amortization. And so after 20 years, that big layer will be paid off.
We don't have very many years left on that, do we?
No, we're coming up. So it was done in 2013. So in 2033 is the year that it gets paid off. And so you'll see a little bit how that's going to impact contributions.
And we're also in a position where once you get, we'll go to a place where we're 100%. But when you have a system that's way over 75%, I think, is the deal, they consider that a very healthy pension plan and will be far in excess of that when we get to the final place. But it's my understanding, and I'm kind of confirming this because it changes year to year, I believe our annual contribution by the county is about half a billion a year. Mm-hmm. Is that
correct? That's correct, yes.
And then after this is completed, the 20-year is completed, it goes to about $150 million?
That sounds about right.
Plus or minus?
Yeah, it'll vary depending on what salaries
are. It'll
vary,
and salaries will have gone up, and, X plus Z minus Q, but all of those kind of things. Okay, I just wanted to confirm what I was thinking.
Yes.
This is one of our favorite presentations every
fantastic.
Year.
Fantastic. I love delivering good news and things that people like to hear about. So this
is great. All the employees actually listen to this one. A lot of them are just talking otherwise, but for this one, they listen.
We all have a vested interest, so I understand. So that big layer that was created in 2012 is every year getting amortized. That's what part of that $500 billion that the county makes is paying down. But then each year, all of those other items that I just talked about, those create another layer of UAAL. And what we do each year is we create another 20-year layer. And so as much as when that first really big layer gets paid off, they'll still, every year, you're going to have some years where it's a gain that we don't recognize at all. We don't take the benefit of it immediately. It gets spread out over 20 years. But then you also have years where there's losses, and those get spread out. Those are going to, they are, and they will continue to be much smaller layers. And so you just will, you will keep that lower contribution rate and higher funded ratio over time with this new, I say new, it's 15 years in, 12 years in of this, funding policy that the board has adopted. So visually, this is a illustration that our actuary, Siegel, prepares for us every year. It's a great planning tool to be able to say, when is this full funding going to happen? When are we going to pay off the UAAL? And what we have them do each year is do it under three scenarios. We look at where we're starting from. So in this, it's the December 31st, 24 UAAL. And we say, what if we have a really good investment year and we double our rate of return? What will it look like? And then every year after, we assume we hit every assumption. What will that look like? And that's the green line. And then you look at what if we just hit our assumed rate in 2025 and every year thereafter. That's what the blue line is. And then if we have a great year, hit it out of the park, investments are great, and we double our assumed rate of return, great year is the green line. No return. So if we have a bad year and it's zero, that's the red line. But it shows you kind of how that's paid down. And then what you see down here, you see the amounts, and you can see that 2031 under the really good year, which I'm going to knock on wood, we're having a very good year, but we know that this goes till December 31st, and nobody knows what's going to happen between now and then. But what we've been focusing as we're looking in for planning purposes, we're above 12% for the year so far. We think it's reasonable to at least look at the blue line, if not somewhere in between there and the green line of where we'll be. And so you can see that we're looking at full funding, 2031, 2033 time period. And this is for the full plan with all all organizations, all of the employers in there. I included in here too specifically rate group two, because that's the county's largest portion of employees. This is all your general employees. So you can see pretty much tracks where the full fund is, because it is the biggest group. And but you'll see under those scenarios, again, you're looking at full funding in 2032 to 2034, 35, depending on how the investments do. Yes?
We have a question.
Exposure does OSERS have to like the late 90s dot-com bubble or the Great Recession? Like, this is, I mean, even 0% is pretty good compared to, I mean, obviously we're still paying for the Great Recession.
We are. So when you say exposure to, do you mean in our... in
like AI bubble pops in the next year and been driving the entire U.S. economy lately?
We have a very diverse asset allocation, so there is definitely exposure, but what our board tries to do is balance the desire and need to get returns with limiting risk. I'll show you in a few slides how that's changed over the years, but we move, I mean, we invest our assets in many different categories. So we have our public equities, which you would have a lot of that risk in there. You also have bonds, real estate, real assets. You've got private equity. And so they really try to diversify across all different types of investments to mitigate those risks of one event really dominating the portfolio and the performance.
I'm going to ask piggyback on the same question. So your downside scenario is a 0%, and so is that really what you think a bad year is? That is a 0%, or is it really a negative 7%?
We've had bad years. 2008 is a great example of that.
There, but you know, what's a bad year?
2008 was minus 18, I believe. Yeah.
And it was also the first year of the program for all. It was probably very fun.
Yeah, so, and that's the extreme, right?
Right.
I mean, 2008 was a very extreme year. But if I can fast forward and you can kind of see what our returns have been. Over, you know, the last 5 years, we've averaged 8. And when you look at the 15, we've been averaging 7.4. So we recognize that there will be market downturns. We know that they will happen, and we try to plan accordingly. So I'm going to flip back. So looking at kind of where we are, the county is compared to the other employers participating in OSERS, we have a range of different funding levels, and that's a result of just different plans, but then also different funding mechanisms. We have some of our employers who have reserves that were available for them to pay off their liabilities. So you have people like the sanitation district, the toll roads, law library, the cemetery district. They've all made additional contributions to really pay down that unfunded liability. But you can kind of see that the county is our biggest employer. And in rate group two, the funding ratio is just under that 80%. And then when you look at the safety plans, they're at 85 and 83% funded. So doing well and headed in the right direction. So contribution rates, this is what impacts the employers every year on their budget. So this is very important. And so what does all of this mean for those contribution rates? This is this slide has become known as the cliff slide. And so what you're seeing here in that 2034 area, 2033, 2034, is that's when that big layer of UAAL gets paid off. And so you have contributions now. You're no longer having to pay on that big layer, and the contribution rates decline significantly for the employers. And so this is going to be and is a big focus for OSERS over the next 6 months to a year, because what does that mean? You mentioned that we will have less contributions coming in. Well, we still, the benefit payments going out are going to continue to grow. So we'll have a different cash flow that we'll have to adjust for. So we're going to be looking at two things. One, if we just let the contribution rates go as they are, what does that mean for our portfolio? We'll now need to look at liquidity. We'll have to change that asset mix a little bit to be prepared to continue to make those benefit payments. So that means you're going to do a little bit less illiquid. That maybe those illiquid investments might be gaining a lot of investment returns. So we'll have to look at what we need to do to the portfolio, and that could impact what it means for our assumed rate of return. If you're going to take some of those longer items out that have great returns, we might need to then look at what we're assuming for our return in the future. So when you do a change in assumption like that, what does it do? It creates, you may have heard the equation for a pension system. What we pay out are our benefits, and we have to pay expenses. Those two items are paid for by either contributions or investment returns. So if we change what we assume we can earn in investments, that equation has to balance. Contribution rates would have to go back up. So what we're going to be working on over the next 6 months is how can we keep it? It's important for everybody to know what's coming in the future. So to have this cliff and then maybe have a change of a assumption in your investment returns, they offset each other. We're going to start trying to plan to make that as smooth as possible. So we've been talking about an asset or a smoothing method to glide into this instead of go over the cliff. And when a cliff sounds scary, this is a good cliff, because who doesn't want your contribution rates to go down? So it is a good problem to have. It's just we're going to be very intentful, very careful to really plan. We'll be working with the county. We'll be working with our board and the actuaries to really figure out what's the best way to glide into that to avoid volatility.
When do you think you'll be putting the glide into plan?
That is a great question.
Position here where in real time, that's not very far away.
It is not.
And we've had some good years, and so, you know, that also affects this as well. When are we thinking the glide into plan will come in?
We are actively planning for those conversations next month and through the beginning of the year so that we can have the plan in place. When we talk to the investment team, they need a good couple of years, 3 years, to really start adjusting the portfolio. So when you're talking about a 2033 cliff, we need to start looking at the portfolio next year, the year after, to make those adjustments. So it's an active conversation that's really going to start gaining a lot of energy and activity around over the next 4 to 5 months. With a glide path, so when do things change? It could be as soon as the following year, so 27. It could maybe, depending on what the glide path or how, you know, what comes of it, it could be a couple of years after that. But we'll need to plan for it before 2033, because that is happening.
We'll have
absolutely. So the other way to look at this, which is really interesting, this is where you kind of see the conversation I had about all of those other annual layers that we have. The big orange layers, that's paying off that big 2012 reamortization. And once that's paid off, you still have all of these other layers. You know, we've made changes over that same period. We reduced our assumed rate of return. We were originally at 7.75. We went down to 7.25, and then we lowered it again down to 7%. So that created some unfunded liability, because now we're assuming we're not getting it from investment returns. And so that definitely impacted it. We've also lowered our assumption on inflation rates. We assume that people are living longer, and all of those created some assumption plan changes. We also have those gains and losses. So you see some years we have gains and losses on different assumptions that we make. But when you hit that big layer being paid off, this is where I say, even with those other layers, the contribution rates will be lower.
So is the goal to be at 100% when we're done all the time?
You will never be exactly 100%, in my opinion, because you have all of these annual fluctuations.
Fluctuate between 90 and 100%.
I think so.
Period. In the green period.
Yes. And so how have we done this? We've kind of hit on this already. A big portion of what's allowed us to improve our funding ratio is our portfolio and the performance that we've had. There are markets upturns and downturns, and we plan accordingly to be able to weather that storm. But when you look at how do we do compared to other pension systems, we participate in this study done by RVK. There's about 65, 66 plans that participate. And this, the first slide I'm showing you here is how we compare over 10 years. And you can see that we're better than half of them. But one of the things that happened is we changed our chief investment officer about 8 years ago. And when Ms. Murphy came in, a lot of attention and focus and refocus on the portfolio was made. And our board made the strategic decision to move away from being so conservative that it became a little bit more acceptive of saying we can take on a little risk. We were very risk adverse. We were in, you know, we typically were performing down in this range compared to our peers. And so they took a very measured approach, very small, nothing drastic, but moved a little bit more money into the equity, private lending. And that has resulted in a much better performance in comparison to our peers. So this is a 5-year. So when you look at the 10-year, a couple years without our current investment allocations, you look at the 5-year, we've definitely done much better compared to our peers. And then on an annual basis, this was last year's performance. So we're in that top third compared to our peers, which has really helped us improve that funded ratio. One item that if you're really interested in the UAL that we keep up to date is every year, kind of that chart I showed you of how we moved to our UAL this year compared to last year, that we have a document that does that for every year. So you can really see how did we end up with our UAL and how are we paying it down. And that's found on our website. It's called the Evolution of the UAL. And with that, that concludes my presentation. Any other questions?
I have a quick question. Appreciate the comparison to on the rate of returns for other counties. Do we have a similar type chart for what percentage of UAAL is?
We have funded ratio. We do have that. It's not in the presentation. I don't believe I put that in.
But are we generally better?
We are a little more than halfway, better than more than half, kind of similar to where we are in the 10-year chart. We're about in that general area.
And then, we kind of referenced this 75-80% mm-hmm. Type goal. A goal should always be 100%, I think.
Yes, that's the goal.
Right? But so when that 80% goal is referenced in my head, I automatically go, well, was that generated when everyone's at 60%, they're going, oh, if we could just get to 80, we'd feel a lot better? Or is there a reason, rationale behind an 80% is doing well? Obviously, 100% is where you're shooting for, but like, what is the rationale for an 80% funding? And hopefully it's not just that, well, yeah, that's what it was when we were at 50%. We want to get, improve.
A lot of factors go into that. And that's where I had made the caveat that if you put an actuary up here, they're not going to tell you that 80% is the goal. The goal is 100%. But getting there, where do you feel like you have the flexibility to maybe you have the enough assets where you can spread them across, have more asset diversification in your portfolio, your cash flows are good. That's where that 80% really gives you a little bit more of that flexibility and you have more on hand for those future payments. I think the other side, that's just a single factor, but you also have to look at what are your funding policies. So that is, to me, a bigger driver. Somebody could be at 80% but have funding policies that are not as stable and strong as somebody who maybe is at 70%, but they're using a closed short 20 or less amortization period. That they have strong, their assumptions are more realistic. And when you look at funding policies, that really drives when are you going to get to that 100%. The funded ratio is just a marker to kind of track your progress. And 80 is just kind of an industry. I wouldn't say that there's a deep rationale that says you are good at 80%, because again, I think you have to dig down a layer further to say, but what are your funding policies?
Any further questions? Ms. Schott, thank you very much. Oh, I'm sorry.
Thank you, Chair Roden. I just want to really thank Brenda for coming. I sit as the ex officio member on the OSERS Pension Board, one of nine board members there with an alternate. And I know that Steve, I just talked with him. He was so unhappy, not unhappy, but he loves coming to this meeting. It's always a great opportunity. One of the things I talked with Steve about was that 20-year amortization, that it really has made a huge difference in the county. I was on the board in 2012 and actually had asked for the amortization schedule. And it's like we didn't start paying principal till year 21. And negative amortization we know is bad. And Steve is so perceptive. He has already included it in this report, because at that point we saved over $500 million in interest by making the change from the 30 to 20. The PEPRA, of course, has helped, but I think, as Ms. Schott has indicated, we really have a great team. Our CIO, Molly, really has done an excellent job. I am very risk adverse because, of course, that's the accountant side of it. And so I look a lot at the standard deviation, and the good news is we have been under on the risk from what our projected was, which is very helpful. Obviously, there could be cliffs that come up with the AI and different technology and really diversifying the asset portfolio. And then, you know, Brenda is here and does an excellent job. She really leads all of the accounting, all of the things that you guys do. She is in charge of all the systems, accounting systems, and tracking all that. And, you know, I just want to thank her for coming, and certainly Steve for his communications and everything. And they really are doing a great job for the county, who is the largest member here. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yes.
Yeah. We also, just for the benefit of this group, we meet with OSERS on a monthly basis, and we really enjoy those meetings. They keep us up to date on everything that's going on. What you're seeing here, we've seen before. We've actually incorporated that into our strategic financial plan, so we are planning for that. Looking forward to that cliff and that your cliff, my windfall. happy for that. But I also want to point out that when you see her numbers and her investment returns, and you heard our report about our wonderful 4% we're so proud of, their rules are different than ours. Yes. I want to point out that she can do the more long-term properties and a lot more options for her to invest in, and we are limited. So I want to point out that's why we are 4. She is above 4, and we are including this in our strategic financial plan.
Okay, and just to reiterate, for those of you that are under this retirement system, you should be really proud of what's going on, because a lot of the, I'm on a different retirement system, but you're doing a good job. And we've seen it year after year since I've been on the committee. And so you guys should be proud that you got someone really working hard for your retirement, and the measures that are being taken proactively to continue. So thank you again for your presentation.
Thank you. You're very welcome.
Okay, Madam Clerk, could you read the next item,
please? Item 10 is to receive and file a report on required communication from external auditors. And David Showalter was unable to be here, so we have Kinley Sukasium from Ide Bailey to present on this item.
Hi, can everyone hear me? All right, good morning. My name is Kinley Sukasium, and I'm with Ide Bailey. I'd like to provide just a brief status of the county's external audits. Should I hold on? Oh, I don't know if I could.
Hold on. Okay, so no, it's just in the agenda.
Okay, so it's just included in the agenda packet. So we've issued the GAN limit agreed upon procedures report for the county and the flood control district. We've also completed our audit of the district attorney grant audits. As far as the audits of the county's overall financial statements, the John Wayne Airport and Orange County waste and recycling audits, Those audits are currently undergoing our fieldwork right now, and our plan is to issue those audit opinions by next month. So we should be wrapped up and finalized by December. And that's my brief status.
Any questions, discussion? Thank you.
You can read the next item, please.
Yes, item 11 is to approve Internal Audit Department quarterly status report and approve executive summary of internal audit reports for the quarter ended September 30th, 2025. And we have Jose Olivo, Deputy Director of Internal Audit Department, to present this item.
Good morning. Before you is our report on audit activity for the quarter ending September 30th, 2025. During this quarter, we issued a total of five final reports and two draft reports. Of the five final reports, four were for original audits and one was a follow-up. The four original reports included five significant control weaknesses and seven control findings, and I'll focus on the significant weaknesses. Before I get into that, I just wanted to touch on one of the reports that we issued during the quarter was the second phase of the board-directed ARPA audit. If you recall, this was an audit of ARPA-funded contracts and their compliance with contracting requirements. During the first phase, we reviewed 58 expenditures, totaling $203 million, and we made six recommendations for improvement. During this second phase, we reviewed 285 expenditures, totaling $42 million, and we didn't identify any new issues and didn't make any new recommendations during this second phase. But the recommendations from the first phase continue to apply. We have a planned follow-up follow up on the status of these recommendations early in the next calendar year. Of the reports with significant control weaknesses, we had two of those. The first was an audit that we contracted with MGO to perform. This was an audit of waste management's compliance with their county contract, which is administered by the OC Waste and Recycling. The audit noted two significant control weaknesses. The first was that customers were being charged for services that did not match the descriptions in the county contract. Auditors recommended for OCWR to review the services that Waste Management's billing system had to ensure that they were only billing for the agreed upon services. The second significant control weakness was that residential customers appear to have been charged commercial rates for manure services. And there appears to be some confusion over the rates for these services. So the auditors recommended for Waste Management and OCWR to work and agree on the rates and to document the agreed upon rates in the county contract. OCWR agreed with the findings and recommendations, and we will also be conducting a follow-up on this audit. The other report with significant control weaknesses was a cybersecurity audit of OCWR. We had three significant control weaknesses, and these reveal IT vulnerabilities, so the findings have been restricted. However, in accordance with our new restricted reporting policy, which Aggie will touch on shortly, this information will be made public once during a future follow-up once we make sure that the risk has been mitigated and the corrective action has been implemented. And that concludes my report. And any questions?
So can you just tell us how the way in which we're going to be more transparent is going to occur now?
Yeah, Mark, we have an update on the restricted reporting policy, and I'll provide it as part of that, if that's okay. Or I could bring it up and talk about it now.
Question.
Yeah.
Any further question or discussion? Madam Clerk, next item, please.
Actually, this last item was I approve the quarterly status report.
Okay, it's been moved by Mark Willey, second by Drew Atwater. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Seeing no oppositions or abstentions, motion approved. Madam Clerk, next item, please.
Item 12 is to approve external audit activity quarterly status report for the quarter ended September 30th, 2025, and receive and file report on status of external audit recommendations implementation. And we have Aggie Alonso, Director of Internal Audit Department, to present this item.
Thank you. Good morning still, everyone. As you all know, on a quarterly basis, we report to the Audit Oversight Committee any external audits that have been done. And we also notify the committee of anything significant, anything material. And we also report back on corrective action that's taken. So for this last quarter, ending September 30th, 2025, the county, the department's reported a total of 8 external audits being conducted. Of those 8 audits, none of them had any material disallowances, which we define as anything over 100,000. But there was one audit that had a 2 significant issues. That audit related to cybersecurity, and it was of the clerk recorder. Because of the sensitive nature of those cybersecurity findings, they have been restricted. But similar to our process, we will be reporting back on the department's reports in terms of what corrective action was taken in regards to those recommendations. So although we the findings are restricted, once the corrective action has been taken, it's been implemented, we'll report back on that in the future.
And Aggie, I think it'd be important to identify that the there's some transparency with the chair and vice chair where they are informed about these non-public items. And so there are people that are on the committee that do review this.
Good point. Thank you, Mark. And yeah, just to expand on that, these are external reports, so those aren't part of our briefing with the chair and vice chair. However, we do brief the chair and vice chair for internal audit reports that our office conducts. So this one is part of the external audit reporting. To the extent information is available, we can always work with counsel if, you know, the chair or vice chair would like to see more information. But in terms of reporting, we're going to keep it restricted, consistent with our protocols and stuff. But thank you for that, Mike. I'm sorry, Mark. The other thing we also, like I said, mentioned, we report back on the implementation status. At the last meeting, we had a significant material finding related to the Short Doyle Medi-Cal cost report. It was a disallowance of $11.6 million. In terms of repayment on that, the county HCA, they're waiting for the State Department of Health Services to send the invoice for repayment. So once they make that repayment back, then the finding will be resolved and addressed. And that concludes my report on external auditing. I do have a couple of announcements I'd like to make, and I figured this is a good place as any. Last time around, I introduced a couple of new hires that we had, but one of our new seniors wasn't around, so I'd like to introduce him today. His name is J.C. Lim. If you could please stand, J.C. So, as I mentioned last time, he came to us from Auditor Controller Internal Audit Unit. And another announcement I'd like to make related to J.C., he just recently, today, found out, or at least I found out, he passed the Certified Fraud Examiner. So another certification. And I also want to announce Liz Serta, one of our new seniors who was here at our last meeting, and I did present her to you all. She's now a certified public accountant. Congratulations on that. And lastly, we have a new hire, also from the Auditor Controller. He trained such great, amazing staff. But we were fortunate enough to hire Nicole Anastasio for OC Waste and Recycling, and she's our newest senior. And so I'm pleased to report with the CEO and CFO's support that we are now fully staffed. So thank you for allowing me to do that. And thanks again, Mr. Hamilton, for training such great staff. Appreciate that. And that completes my report.
No question, but just a comment. But great news, and then congratulations, everybody. That's fabulous. I've also been one that has stolen from Auditor Controller's office, so I know that they're great staff. But on the Medi-Cal, the short Doyle, the cost report, I'd like to make a comment because it's an audit finding, but it really is a true up. So it really, we always say it's a finding. We come in here like this is an $11 finding, but it's actually a true up. So during the year, HCA has received payments and payments and payments, and that cost report is just to kind of reconcile how much were you paid and how much were the services. So it's just a true up. So they always get, when I used to come here, I used to get like, it's not a finding, it's a true up. So I was going to give a shout out to HCA. It wasn't a huge audit issue, but it's a true up of the incurred and paid. So thank you.
Thank you for that, Kim.
And thank you, Auditor Controller, for all the wonderful staff.
Just stay. You can stay with us.
Can I get a motion to approve?
I move that we approve number 12.
Second.
Yeah, Tim will approve, or a second.
Okay, a motion was made by Mark Willey, second by Tim Johnson. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Any opposition or abstention? Seeing none, the motion carries. Madam Clerk, next item, please.
Item 13 is to receive an update on the forensic audit, and Aguilanzo, Director of Internal Audit Department, will provide the update on this item.
Thank you, Valerie. Hey, hello everyone, it's me again. As I've reported in previous AOC meetings, I wanted to give an update on where we're at with this, consistent with previous board action, going back to December 3rd, 2024, where they asked us to contract out with an external firm to conduct a forensic audit of contracts that were funded by ARPA, CARES, MHSA, and General Fund. At the September 23rd board meeting, we were directed to bring the top three scoring proposals to the board for their selection of a firm. On October 14th, the board selected the firm Weaver and Tidwell to conduct the forensic audit. And on Tuesday of next week, we will be bringing the contract with Weaver and Tidwell to the board for their final approval. As I mentioned in previous updates, this is an audit consisting of over 2,500 contracts totaling over $4.3 billion. We're doing the audit in phases based on priority. So we phased and ranked the contracts based on risk. So the first phase includes 145 contracts. And after the contract gets signed on November 18th, we're having our kickoff meeting that afternoon with Weaver and Tidwell. And of course, contingent on Weaver and Tidwell getting all the documentation necessary for them to conduct their forensic audit. If they're able to get all the documentation, the timeline for them to finish the first phase and start getting some results back on the forensic audit is going to be February 24th, 2026. So we're going to start getting some results back on the board motion. And I just wanted to mention that not only will there be a final report, and that's what's due on February 24th, subsequent to that, they're required to come contractually present to the board the results of the review. So there's a lot of transparency built into the contract, and we're moving forward. And I just wanted to give you an update on where we're at. So that concludes my presentation.
So Aggie, I've got a question about this. So we're in a position where we want to know what happened, right? And so we'll have a better idea about what happened during the period. And of course, from that, we'll look at it and see are there, we've changed a lot of things, but are other things that should be changed? Is this intended to be used for any kind of litigation support? Or is there
great
intention
question.
In that way? Or
great question. This excludes any contract or payment or anything that's already under the purview of the county under litigation. And so this wouldn't include any of the contractors related to the former supervisor. Those are excluded from this. So this is stuff that the county's not aware of, not in litigation, not with the district attorney. It includes everywhere.
So this is informational as opposed to...
So then we'll see if there's widespread, if there's any other issues with any contracts. And it's very broad. It goes all the way from 2019 till 2024. August of 2024. So it's a very...
And again, it's not probably the right question for you. It might be the right question for Ronnie. If we find anything in this, are we still in the statute of limitations for litigation?
Civilly, I'm not sure. But there is a provision in the contract where if fraud is found, that's immediately reported to county council and the DA's office for further investigation.
Just of interest about whether we're after the fact or whether we're right on the fact with some of these dates.
And one thing just to add, the board did make a motion to ensure that all documentation's maintained related to this time period, because there's retention requirements, right, that are, I mean, some of this goes back over 5 years, so and obviously Ronnie could speak more eloquently related to this order, but it's been required all documentation to be maintained so that this forensic audit can happen and we can actually see what happened. So that did happen.
And it might be of interest as we finish with this, we do look at this and say, are there things we, you know, maybe another project for, I think I would put it on the burner someplace in our agenda that as this gets finished, we should look at it critically for changes we should make, COSO or otherwise.
Sure, absolutely. I appreciate that. And one thing I did want to, the board has and CEO have already made many, many reforms related to this. And one of the biggest ones related to discretionary funds, they're all required to go through the county purchasing office. And that's the gold standard for purchasing. They follow all the requirements. They publish the CPM. And they're also required to go before the full board for approval. So in terms of the discretionary funds and some of those payments and contracts, that's now been the improvements that have been made have been very well.
We'll also have Andrew's new disbursement software
ERP,
working at the same time, right?
Absolutely.
Okay, that concludes my report on the forensic audit.
Any further questions, discussions? Thank you. Madam Clerk.
Item 14 is to receive and file Internal Audit Department's restricted report policy, and Aggie Alonso from the Director of Internal Audit Department will present this item.
Thank you. I'm going back to back to back like the Dodgers next year, hopefully. So at the last meeting, I reported on our restricted reporting policy, Mark, and as part of that presentation, we talked about, and we've had conversations too, obviously, but you know, we're always weighing the public's right to know and obviously, you know, protecting the county. And it's something that we're constantly evaluating. So I'd want to give big thanks to the CEO and CIO who we collaborated with this. We're still protecting the county, but we're being more transparent. And how are we doing that? When we initially do an audit and we note a significant or critical issue and the vulnerability still exists, we're going to issue those reports restricted. But as we do follow-ups, as you all know, 6 months, a year after, as things are implemented, then at that point, we can report back to the public and everyone else related to the corrective action and that the finding has been addressed and corrective action has been taken. At that point, there's no longer a vulnerability because it's been addressed. Now, as part of these public reports, we're still not going to give any information that, you know, any of the hackers or some of these bad actors could use against us, you can generically write up. But it's a way of being transparent with some of these restricted reports while still maintaining, you know, obviously, you know, ensuring that none of our vulnerabilities with our systems are potentially exploited. So that's our new process. We had it work collaboratively. We shared it with Casey and Ed and company, and everyone's in agreement with how we're doing this, and this isn't an approval. It's just FYI, because I like bringing things to the AOC. So this is just more receive and file. Just so you know, this is our new policy. We've already implemented it, and you'll start seeing some of our follow-ups be issued publicly with the results. So
So, you know, Aggie, when we first started seeing these internal control issues at the county, we found that there was, you know, we'd get to the next department and they'd have a very similar default, if you will. And this has been now 5 or 7 years that we've been continually saying these things that we wanted to keep quiet publicly because of the sensitive nature of the items. I'm concerned that we aren't, since they're very similar in nature between departments, that we aren't, during this period of time, getting the departments themselves to kind of realize this and not wait for the internal auditors to come in and say, you're terrible, you know, and for them to get a black mark. Has anything been done countywide to try to get people to look at these things in advance rather than in the gotcha phase?
Yeah, I mean, we developed some training, which included an IT component. But I think OCIT and in our department, we've collaborated when there's findings that are systematic in nature. And not to put Ed on the spot or anything, but I see him in the audience. For example, like one of the, well, I don't know how much I should talk here, but we have some common findings that we've developed some, or we didn't develop, but we have some software now that addresses like employees terminating, and that way, it's an automatic feature to allow the department to know, hey, you need to remove these people from system XYZ. Or so there's some systematic improvements. I'm talking about the MIM identity software, and I think I can name that. But so there are some things that I know OCIT and we do to try to ensure that, you know, anything that we see systematically, if there's some type of cure or something we can do, we certainly try to do those things.
I'm kind of, it's not... I'm not looking at your or IT because you guys do a great job. It's these departments not getting the word that they need to fix this stuff. And so I'm not sure it's something we can solve with the people that are here, but what is the right way for us to incentivize, identify, what is the right way to make sure that the departments get a, you know, get a two
right,
by four to someplace to let them know that you
absolutely.
Know, it seeing another one of these IT issues with another department that we just hadn't got to yet seems like we should have a better system than that. And I don't know the answer to that. Maybe it's all, you know, Andrew, if more of your employees could be spread throughout the county, we might be able to fix that, but I don't know.
If I could, so Ed Althoff, I'm the Chief Technology Officer, Assistant CIO for OCIT. And I think what we're seeing is a trend. So more agencies now are coming under the fold of our cybersecurity systems. There are still some agencies that are independent or more so independent. But there's been a trend for more and more agencies to become members of our security operations center. So we're having oversight into the...
Is that completely voluntary, Ed? or do we, you know, I thought like they worked for the County of Orange. And I would think that, you know, I think you guys have been reporting to us for about 7 or 8 years. And so I just did not realize that your involvement with them was voluntary.
We have enterprise customers. We have a mix of customers. And so we have what we call managed services customers, shared services customers. Some agencies use more of our services. Some use less. And some of those agencies that use less, sometimes those are elected officials, and sometimes there's other... nuances. So, but I think what we've saw, or what we've seen probably most recently in the last couple of years, so there was an incident at one of the agencies, a cyber incident, and that I think opened eyes to a lot of different other agencies that there's a benefit of utilizing OCIT services. And so that trend I think is still gaining some momentum. And to your question, is it voluntary? In some cases, they are provided to have those options, those choices. I think it would be nice if they all became under the fold of our security operations systems, but that's not something that we can necessarily change like that.
You know, we're an oversight committee. We don't do anything, right? And so it would seem to me that we should just let the supervisors know that it's voluntary as opposed to mandatory. And if it needs to be mandatory, which I would think it would be, but I don't know everything about the county, but if I was a supervisor, I would want these kind of things to be mandatory and not voluntary. And I think we should somehow highlight that to supervisors. That's my only comment.
I think that's a great suggestion.
We have certainly, when we go to departments, and like Ed was saying, there's different levels of service they can get, but when they have the full service OCIT, that reduces the risk in our mind, because they are the gold standard in terms of, you know, that's what they do, and they have the right controls, and that doesn't mean there's not findings.
I would just hope the county would have all of us on the gold standard.
There's elected department heads, there's appointed department heads, there's some complexities, but we well received, and we'll certainly take that into account.
Any further questions, discussion? Thank you. Madam Clerk, next item, please.
Item 15 is to receive and file the quarterly status report of auditor controller mandated audits for quarter ended September 30th, 2025. And we have Rodrigo Martinez, audit manager with auditor controller, to present on this item.
Hey, good afternoon. So since our last meeting, we completed all of our prior year cash shortages. So we're up to date for the cash shortages. We're working currently on five that are in progress. For the JPAs and special districts, this is where we receive their financial statements. We have one still outstanding, and we should have this one completed by the end of this year. We just collected and posted our site for this one. So the next item is the review of schedule of assets. For the quarters of 9/30/2024, 12/31/24, and March 31st, 2025, the draft report was provided to the Treasury Department, and so far for two of those, we received the management representation letter and hoping to have those completed and issued soon. We are also working on the new year of the review of schedule of assets, which is the quarter for 9/30/2025, and the last one is the probation of juvenile books accounting, which is a 2 years review ended on June 2025. That's my update for this quarterly meeting. Does anyone have any updates or questions, should I say?
Thank you. Next item, please.
I think we have to move item number 15. We just received it.
That was a receive and file.
Item 16 is to receive the update on ERP implementation, and we have Andrew Hamilton, Auditor Controller, to present this update.
All right, red is on. So we have been working hard, Auditor Controller, along with various subject matter experts that are on the implementation team, and we're making great progress. The next go live is approximately 8 months from now, which includes the budget. And in 12 months after that, 20 months from now, GL Financials procurement is scheduled for after that is HR payroll, which is January 1st of 2028. So that is a brief update. And
Any questions?
Thank you. Next item, please. Item 17 is to receive and file 2024 Orange County Fraud Hotline Annual Report, an overview of the fraud investigation process. And we have Ronnie Magsaysay, Senior Deputy County Counsel, to present this item.
Thank you. Under Rule 7.1.9 of the committee bylaws, the AOC's responsibility to ensure that the county has procedures for the receipt, retention, investigation, and treatment of fraud hotline complaints, and so that's the purpose of this item, to fulfill that responsibility. So I'll give a brief overview of the fraud hotline, what it is, how it operates, introduce the annual report that was submitted to the Board of Supervisors in June this year, and I also have Patrick Brusso from County Council's office, who kind of manages and operates the fraud hotline for our office. Under Government Code 53087.6, it authorizes the county to operate a whistleblower hotline to receive calls from persons who have information regarding fraud, waste, or abuse within the county, such as county employees or vendors. The fraud hotline was initially established in 1994, and in 2015, the Board of Supervisors delegated the responsibility for the operation of the hotline to County Council's office with a partnership with the Auditor Controller's office. As far as the process, a lot of this is detailed in the report, but I'll give a brief overview. So the County Council's office, we operate a phone line and website to receive complaints. Since 2016, we've used an outside vendor to kind of handle those, the intake of those, because it's operated 24/7, 365 days a week. Complainants are able to provide information anonymously. They're given a password so that they can log into the system, provide further information, and then the county can communicate with them to keep them anonymous. Fraud Hotline gets a diverse and varied set of complaints. A lot of them don't necessarily fall within the county's jurisdiction. You know, you might get a complaint that, you know, my landlord took more money than he was supposed to, so that clearly doesn't fall within Fraud Hotline's jurisdiction. Fraud Hotline also does not investigate welfare and consumer fraud complaints. Those are would be sent to the district attorney's office for investigation. Also get a lot of complaints regarding city or special district or other governmental activities that fall outside of the purview. But when Fraud Hotline does receive a complaint, it's logged into a system, and then notice is given to the Auditor Controller's office. The County Council team and Fraud Hotline conducts a preliminary review to see if the matter should be investigated. When they review and see there is a substantiated complaint, Fraud Hotline will either assign to the Auditor Controllers to investigate, either in conjunction with County Council or just the Auditor Controller's office. It can refer it to another governmental department for their investigation at their discretion. So if we get a complaint that, you know, there's misconduct at a city, we'd forward that to the city, and then it's at their discretion whether or not they want to investigate that. We can assign it to another county department for investigation, or investigate directly by County Council, or County Council's office could retain an outside investigation firm to conduct the investigation. As far as the 2024 annual report, just broadly regarding some of the statistics, for calendar year 2024, we received 498 allegations. 26 of those were new cases. 466 were items that were referred out. And six were, there was insufficient information or non-actionable items that, you know, there's no investigation that needed to take place. Other than that, I'm happy to answer any detailed questions.
I have one. On page 5, under the financial fraud assistance, there's a case that is ongoing from 2021, and it says as of today's date, it's still unresolved. Is there a statute of limitations on this particular issue? And I understand there's a lawsuit involved. Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
I am, but we're not supposed to.
Well, not
confidentiality, so I can't talk to the specifics of that case. There was a lawsuit involved in that case that has just recently been resolved, so we picked up our investigation again. But as far as I'm aware, there's currently no issues with statute of limitations or anything like that.
That was my, not the, the confidentiality and details was just an update on where we are on that one.
Right.
Yes.
And I can speak to that. We're currently working with the county's CEO real estate on that case. They're currently investigating whether there was actually wrongdoing.
Also, it mentioned in here that you have a third party that take the calls that come in and so forth. And then you have a process where they can go on the website and make complaints and so forth. As for the website, the people that are getting that information, is it an appointed or a selected group of people that do that in terms of being able to maintain the confidentiality? Okay.
The vendor that the fraud hotline uses is Compliance Line. They're also used by other county fraud hotlines. I know HCA has one that they use the same vendor. And I believe as part of that contract, there
can
are
you
certain...
turn on your microphone?
There are certain security measures that are put in place for those vendor employees. However, the way that it works is most of the complaints that we receive are submitted online through that portal. So the vendor employees don't actually see those. They come straight to me and another investigator that work at County Council's office. So only phone complaints would go through the vendor, and they're just there to take the complaints and then send it along to us. So there's security measures involved, but they're not, other than receiving the initial complaint, they're not involved in the process other than that.
Okay. Thank you.
Sure.
Any other questions for the discussion?
Yes.
I was a little confused on the, so this is there was 498 total allegations in 2024, but only 26 of those were new cases. So the other 472, what were those? Were those like repeat?
And I think that's listed somewhere in the report. So the issue that we have is that the fraud hotline has a very good presence both within the county and online. So when people think of just fraud, you know, welfare fraud, housing fraud, or business to consumer fraud types of things, they go and search on, you know, Google or however it is, and they find the fraud hotline and they'll submit a complaint. Unfortunately, we only handle issues of fraud, waste, and abuse within the county by county employees, county vendors, contractors, things like that nature. So the majority of these complaints that we get are not within the purview of the fraud hotline. They're referred out is what we call it, but it means, you know, for welfare fraud, we send that to the DA. For other types of fraud, I basically just reply and say, you know, we can't help you out. We'll try and give resources if we can. You know, for example, someone just recently submitted a complaint about their family member's care at a nursing home. You know, the county, that's not a county issue, it's a private issue. So I'll send them a link to, you know, APS, County Adult Protective Services, or the state has a Department of Healthcare Services, and that's a referral that we give them. We don't take any further action on that. So the 26 cases that you see there that are new cases, those are cases that actually involved county employees, contractors, and vendors that then an investigation was started. All the other cases were either referred to other county agencies like the DA to handle, or they were cases that we just, you know, provide information like legal aid, something like that, but they're not taken on by the county fraud hotline.
Thank you. And another question. I know there's an opportunity for people to report it anonymously. Is there updates provided to someone that does report a fraud?
Yes, there's updates provided on every case. When we take cases on, we don't provide any type of information as to the resolution of that case due to our confidentiality. So what we'll say is, you know, your case has been accepted, but you won't receive any additional information from us as to the resolution of that case, whether it was substantiated or not. But that's given to the complainant, and then they can submit additional information if it may arise for us to look at. So for everybody that submits a case, we will provide an answer to them, and then they can come back in and see what that answer is. And if there's further, you know, information that they have, they can talk to us about that.
Thank you.
Any further discussion? I'd just like to say that it's good to see that the number of substantiated cases are very, very low. So that's a good thing.
Yes.
Okay, Madam Clerk, next item, please. Thank you.
Item 18 is to receive and file County IT Projects Quarterly Progress Report, and we have Ed Althoff, Assistant IT Director and Chief Technology Officer, to present this item.
I'll just read it. It's fine. That's good. All right. So thank you. I know on a quarterly basis, usually Casey is here to provide this report, but similar to the OSER's presentation, Casey is enjoying vacation, so I get to spend some time with you, which is nice. All right. So for the quarterly CIT project progress report, it provides a status on all county IT projects with a budget over $150,000 or more, or that have been identified as meriting Board of Supervisors' attention. So IT projects included in this report reflect the county's ongoing commitment to align IT with county business values. The portfolio covers upgraded or replacement of aging infrastructure, end-of-life systems, and investments in new innovative and reliable technology platforms. In addition to the project status, this report also describes the county's IT overall project performance over the last 12 months. So highlights at a glance, number of projects in this report is 15, four fewer than the previous report. Three of the projects were completed. One of them is the iConnect lab portal from the healthcare agency, multi-drug resistance or organism. Sorry. Well, that was an interesting one. All right. Well, hey. yeah. Okay. So where was I? Yes. A little distracting. So the other one, the data exchange. Okay, and OC recycling and disposal reporting system from OC Waste and Recycling. And one project was canceled, and that was the OC agenda that was being done by a third party. That project has now been focused for an in-house solution, which is progressing very nicely. So key accomplishments. The Microsoft Copilot proof of concept and the privilege access management and OC Compass and employee information tracking system and the mandated report app were all successfully completed. Okay, so next is IT portfolio size and budget. The graph shows the number of active projects is 15. The project data from the last 12 quarters show an average of 17. Total portfolio decreased by 5.4 million, and mostly because of the five completed projects that I highlighted prior. So portfolio performance, seven projects experienced schedule delays. One project exceeded its original re-baseline budget. The scope changes and project dependencies are primarily contributors to project schedule delays. Project overages were primarily due to project scope changes. So project performance trend. So the chart depicts the IT project schedule performance trend for projects that were completed over the last 12 quarters, total number of projects completed, and the number of completed on schedule. So portfolio performance trend, cost schedule trade-off decisions were to stay within resource and budget constraints at the expense of schedule. So that's always one of the balancing things within projects. We'll want to keep things on budget, but sometimes we need to extend the schedule a little bit in order to do that. And project investment trends, projects intended to improve or automate business processes accounted for 87.4%. That's up 35% from the last quarter. Projects for replacing end-of-life or obsolete systems account for 3.6%, which is a 7% decrease from last quarter. And then network projects account for approximately 6% of the budget, which is an 18% decrease. Mandated systems account for about 3%, which is a 4% decrease from the prior quarter. And then investments by service. So certainly the largest investment is our ERP system. And then following, we have our department-specific cybersecurity and protection, public protection systems. So the final page just shows the project landing map. So for this particular quarter, there's kind of a shift on some of the projects. So access control, the Orangewood information system, multi-factor authentication, and our VPN solution. So the next attachment B, is a status update on projects identified as risk or at risk or in critical state for the fourth quarter. And projects highlighted are the access control conversion. That is like the badge access. So we did a conversion from one software solution to another. So that project out of 115 county facilities, now 114 have been transitioned to the last system. Last quarter, I think we were at 70 locations complete. For the county enterprise network redundancy, that's a project that helps us in the event of one area of the county having a catastrophic issue to still have access to certain systems that are in the cloud. So that project so that was delayed somewhat because of the county freeze on our freeze calendar. So when we have certain systems that are critical, like our property tax system as an example, we freeze any changes that we make in other environments just to make sure that, you know, we don't rock the boat. So that's an example of a project being delayed somewhat due to those issues. Third is the privilege access management replacement. So that project is complete. So that's good. And then virtual private network solution. So that's our solution that helps us safely allow people to work remotely or from different locations. And the final customers were completed, Child Support Services and Waste and Recycling. So that project is closed now. And then the two projects for SSA, Employee Information Tracking, and the Mandated Reporter app are also complete. So other than a ridiculous snafu, are there any questions that you have? I don't want to be remembered for that, but.
Any questions or further discussion? Thank you, Ed.
All right, thank you.
Okay, that concludes this meeting of the Investment Oversight and the Audit Oversight Committee meeting. We're now adjourned at.
Can I ask Aggie one question? You know, you've been about a year with this new responsibility.
Performance audits, yes.
Yeah, performance audit and, you know, all the changes. Yes. And I should have asked it earlier.
Sure.
But when I think about this, are you getting enough resources to do all the jobs you have?
No. I can expand. We have $800,000 for performance audit funding. We didn't get any staffing or anything. We got funding for that. So our plan is to contract out until we're able to establish enough capacity. But we would like to do some audits ourselves, contract out some. It depends on the complexity and the nature of the audits. We want to have a full service shop. So
is it it's a budget issue at this point?
Right now, we have $800,000. We're also, as you're aware, in the midst of our contracted risk assessment and audit plan, which is going to drive what we need for performance audits, right? So what do we need? Bear with me, but we'll get more information as we complete the contracted out risk assessment and audit plan. But 800,000 is like 3 or 4 audits, 5. I mean, it depends on the cost, right? So that's not enough to do oversight of all the performance.
You know, Aggie, I appreciate that, and I guess my suggestion is that that we should probably have this as an item on our agenda to discuss, since, you know, we're oversighting you more than anybody.
Yeah.
That we should look at that and get some ideas about, as you meet with the CFO and the CEO about budgetary, and it's the first year in. But I do think it's something we need to highlight on our agenda as opposed to not ask a question about it. I apologize. And I wanted to thank you for being chairman. You've done a great job.
Thank you.
And so this will be your last meeting, at least for now, being chairman. Very nice.
Thank you.
And Yvonne, I wonder if I can mention something about that mail fraud. I didn't realize comments went to the beginning. The mail fraud that we have experienced here in the county, is that too much to ask? This is a committee on fraud, waste, and abuse, and it isn't at the county. I want to first thank Mr. Hamilton here. He contacted me. Gosh, it's been about gosh, at least a month ago, further on a Friday, and had heard about, on a LinkedIn post, some information about some checks that were made out to the County of Orange that were being posted on a LinkedIn site. So I really want to thank him. I then talked with our bank, opened up a case with the sheriff, and we are continuing to get input from taxpayers who are finding that their checks have been mailed and not been cashed by us, so they have not reached us. So we did send out some notices. I know that my communications or my public information officer, Christine, is working with the sheriff to do a joint press release. Hopefully it will go out today or tomorrow, but we appreciate anything that you can do to help communicate. It is not at the county, but of course these are the dollars that pay for 94% of our discretionary funds, and we want to protect those taxpayers. We are encouraging people to essentially, if they've mailed their check, use the QR code on their tax bill. It goes directly to the tax bill on parcel online. They can check to see if their check has been received and processes. Certainly under Dana, our team is doing a great job of processing all of our mailed payments daily. So I do know that we're not delayed on anything. So you should be able to look there and see, and then contacting their bank if it has not been, to see if there is fraud on their account. So it is something that certainly we're not sure of the volume, but we are getting a lot of input on it. And anything you can do to help protect our taxpayers is important in getting the word out. So I do want to thank Andrew. We also got a note from one of the audit committee members, I believe, that had seen that also. So I want to thank them. It is a team effort and collaboration for us, and we're continuing. Of course, the sheriff is the key because they are the ones doing the investigation, and then eventually we've been working with the DA's office also on that. But I did want to at least give a brief update. We did hand out these fraud-resistant pens that we use. We want you to give checks the boot, especially for this reason, and pay online. So we do have some up here, and I've got a few more here for anyone in the back that did not get one. And thank you, Chair Roden, for letting me make a few moments on this case.
It's really great when we see that kind of cooperation inside the county with everybody, you know, doing a little piece of that, and you taking the lead on that. Thank you, Sherry.
And let me just, I'm going to add to that. So I appreciate you, especially encouraging people to check their actual account and not check to see if the check was cashed. Because I have a personal experience with a client of mine that the check was cashed, but it wasn't cashed by the right agency. It was, you know, cashed by a fraudster. And so, you know, you have to check to make sure it was, you know, received by the proper agency. So that's, but, you know, and that would show on their account. So that's super important for folks to do that.
I just wanted to, as this is our last meeting of 2025, a huge thank you to this board for taking on the additional responsibility of the IOC. So thank you, and being the chair at the time, too. I wanted to also extend my appreciation for everything. But to also go back to the performance audit, the $800,000 provided to internal audit had been the budget for the previous years that had not been fully utilized. Provided to internal audit, they're working it out. We're going to see how that goes. We are having some budget challenges this year, so we are working with all the departments as we go forward. So we are weighing what we have, what we can do, and how to meet all of our objectives at the same time. I wanted to share that as well. Thank you.
Thank you for that, Kim. Okay. We are now adjourned at 12:47. And our next regular meeting will be held Thursday, February 5th, 2026, at 10:30 a.m. Thank you, everybody.